On Daf Chaf Amud Aleph. If you count up from the bottom of the page, 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8 lines up. Tan Rabbanan. So Gemara quotes a Braisa, and just by way of introduction, you know, the human mind operates in strange ways. We forget things, but then things stimulate our memory, and we remember things. In the case of Edus, it's critical that the witnesses remember what they claim that they saw. If they don't remember, they can't testify. That's obvious. Even if they wrote down their testimony on a ledger, let's say a diary, you know, you saw something you wrote in your own handwriting in a diary, and you look at it years later and you want to testify, that's not acceptable. Unless you remember it on your own. So that's what this sugya is all about. You know, sometimes a person can walk down a street and see something. He sees a red car go by and he remembers that years ago, you know, that red car or a similar red car went into somebody's field and destroyed his tomato patches. You know, anything could stimulate the memory. Tanu Rabbanan, Kosef Adam Eduso Al Ashtar, a person can write his testimony down on a piece of paper, and if he's afraid he might forget it, he reads what he wrote and it reminds him many years later of what he saw many years earlier. And since he shows up in Beis Din and he testifies based on what he remembers, even though, again, he didn't remember it initially, he only remembered it when he looked at his writings, that's sufficient. Can he produce his writing and say to Beis Din, look, I don't remember anything, but here it is in writing? So we'll soon see that Rashi quotes the halacha of mipiyam velo mipiksavam. That testimony has to be a presentation, a spoken word in front of the Beis Din. You can't just write your Edus and give it to Beis Din. The only exception is that rule is Shtar, which we discussed on various occasions. Amar Rav Huna, V'husha Zochra Me'atzma, which means that although he didn't remember much about the case, he had forgotten a lot of the details before he looked into his Pinkas, into his little diary, but after he looked into his diary, it jolted his memory, and now he remembers the details. And since he remembers the details, he can testify. And that's called Zochra Me'atzma. Zochra Me'atzma means that most of the case he remembers. You know, he remembers there was a loan, it was between you know, Reuven and Shimon, or Reuven lent money to Shimon. He may remember some of the details, but there are many details about the case that he doesn't remember. For example, in order for his testimony to be valid, he has to name the exact time of the testimony, with, you know, when the loan took place, where it took place. Those are called drishos and chakiros. He has to know the answers to those questions. And the only way he's able to jolt his memory is by looking at his diary. Says Rav Huna, that's okay. As long as the basic facts he remembers, even before he looks into the document, he's allowed to use his own writing, his own handwriting, to fill in the missing blanks. As long as he remembers them. Rabbi Yochanan wants to go even a step further. Afal pi she'ein zochra mi'atzmo. Let's say he forgot the entire story from beginning to end. He doesn't remember it. Then he opens up his diary. He reads what he himself wrote in his own handwriting. And now he remembers the entire story with all its details. That's also acceptable. So let's just summarize the machlokus between Rav Huna and Rav Yochanan. They both are explaining this braisa that says, Kosev Adam Edus Al Ashtar. A person can write down his Edus, and then based on what he remembers, after he looks into his shtar, he can testify. Both Rav Huna and Rav Yochanan agree to the one fundamental principle. He's got to remember. He can't testify based on what he's he's written, he's got to remember it. They both agree that at least some of the details he's going to remember only after his memory is jolted by looking at his diary. The machlokas between Rav Huna and Rav Yochanan revolves around the following issue. How much could he have forgotten before he read his diary? Rav Yochanan takes one extreme and he says he could have forgotten everything. He doesn't remember a thing until after he reads his diary. Again, after he reads his diary, he has to remember everything because he's not testifying with the document, he's testifying bal peh. Rav Huna, on the other hand, says no. He's got to remember the case even before he looks into his diary, and then he can fill in some of the details based on what he sees and then remembers. So if you take a look at Rashi, for example, Zochra mi'atzma b'lo re'ias hashtar. He's got to remember some facts of the case before he reads the shtar. And after he reads the shtar, he fills in the blanks and he remembers all the details. Rabbi Yochanan says, "Afal pisha ein zokra mi'atzma li'achar sheroa b'shtar nosan b'libo v'nizkar." In other words, he had forgotten it, but he didn't forget it completely. He forgot it in such a way that he needs something to remind him and to arouse his memory. Im eino nizkar legamre lo, what if he forgot everything, and even after he looks into his diary, he can't remember it? Let him just bring his diary into Beis Din and give the Pinchas into Beis Din. Rashi says, no, that's not acceptable. Drachmona Omar, the Torah says, mi piem velo mi pi ksavam. Which means that a person has to testify personally in front of Beis Din, and if that be the case, he has to remember every single detail of the case. How did he remember every single detail of the case? The event occurred many, many years earlier, and in fact he had forgotten it. The answer is he looked into his diary. According to Rabbi Yochanan, he forgot the entire case. According to Rav Huna, he only forgot part of the case. He remembers the basic event that happened. He just misses some of the details, and that he can arouse his memory and remind himself based on what he fills in the blanks after he reminds himself when he reads his Pinchas. Now, Rashi assumes that there's no way, no how, that he could send his testimony to Beis Din in a written form, because that's mi pi envelo mi pi ksavim. So he can't just produce his diary to Beis Din. If you take a look at Tosus, Dibra Maskil Rabbi Yochanan, at the bottom line of the page on Daf Chof Amud Aleph, he says v'im tomar v'hocha here afilu ein zochra klal, even if he's completely forgotten the event, and not only that, even after he looks at his handwriting, he doesn't remind himself. Mabakach, so what? Yavi shtaro le-Beis Din. Why can he just bring his own handwriting into Beis Din? Now it's interesting that at this point, at least in Tosfos, he doesn't recognize the psul which Rashi had explicitly spelled out. Age Rasha called me pi envelom pi chsavon. And if you take a look for just a second, fast forward about, I'd say, 15 lines, in a line that begins with the word ksavam, he writes, V'rashi pirsh b'peirusho alachumish mipia v'lo mipiksavam shalo yishlach b'ksav eduso le-Beis Din. Now, I'm not exactly sure why Tosfos has to quote Rashi on Chumash. It's pretty Rashi here in the Sugya Fenorot, as we say, on the place, on the spot. He's pretty explicit and outspoken about this. I don't know. But it's clear to me, at least, that at some point, Tosfos introduces the Mipim V'lo Mipi Ksavam, but until that point, Tosfos is totally oblivious to Mipim V'lo Mipi Ksavam. And therefore, if you jump back to the top line in Tosfos, he has to find another answer to justify why this man, if he forgot his Eidus, can't just simply produce his diary to Beis Din, present it to the Dayanim. V'yesh lomar, Tosfos says, Deid echad b'shtar lochasuv shtar. Lochasuv shtar. Tosfos says that the problem with the diary is that the testimony of the diary is only that of one aid. Now, normally, when one aid comes into Beis Din and another aid comes into Beis Din, they both testify to the same effect, then we do what's called Tziruf Kat, which means that we can link them up into one unit, and the unit of testimony has to be comprised of two aid minimum. However, in this case, there's no way, says Tosus, that you could be mitzaref two aidim, one of which remembers nothing about the case, just simply produces his diary to Beis Din. The other one is testifying in front of Beis Din. They don't form one kat. Ella, Tosus is not happy with that because, okay, suppose they don't form a kat, but nevertheless, let one aid be an aid echad b'shtar. And therefore, at least the shtar would be meaningful as far as one aid. Now, what happens if you only have one aid in a monetary case? Is he worthless? No, he's worth something. He's mechayev what? A shmua, right? Aid echad. There are three shmuas that the Torah recognizes. One is modem and miksas. The other is a shmua sashomrim. And the third is aid echad. So let's say Reuven sues Shimon for 1,000, and he brings a shtar that has one aid on the shtar. Shimon denies that he's obligated to pay this money, he would have to take a shvua. So Tosfos says no. A shtar that has only one aid is not even worth one aid. And why is that? Dumya de Sefer HaMakne, and this is a pasuk in Tanakh, and that Sefer HaMakne defines a shtar. And a shtar has to have a self-contained unit of edus. And a unit of edus is two edim. If it's got one ed, it's not a shtar. The Hodi Amar beget Poshut, at the end of Masechet Bavas, says, Eirechem b'ksav, Eirechem b'al peh, ein mitztarfin. We cannot link them up to form a unit of two aid. The mashma that the shtar itself is meaningful, albeit as one aid. Mashma hoshnayim b'shtar afil b'shtei igros mitztarfin. It also seems to imply that you could have one aid signed on one shtar, another aid signed on another shtar, and we can link the two together. Here in our Gemara, it seems that it's absolutely meaningless, it doesn't register at all, if he produces his diary into Beis Din. Tosfos says, Hasam Mayri Kigon She'echad B'shtar V'echad Bal Peh. What does it mean that one is there to testify, the other is only presenting his writing? Lo She'omer She'ra Hu HaMilveh. It's not that he's testifying that he saw Reuven borrow money from Shimon. That would not be a valid shtar, because there's only one aid signed on it. Ella, what's he testifying in this shtar? Shara Mesiris HaShtar, Milo Vilamalva. He's only testifying on the fact that there was a shtar, and that that shtar in his presence was passed on from the Love to the Malva. So it comes out, according to Tosfos, that Eid Echad B'Shtar is not a shtar, and therefore it's meaningless, it's not even valid as one aid. The Torah says Sefer HaMakne, which requires a full-fledged unit of two aidim signed on a shtar in order to validate the shtar. But Tosfos is saying that a person can testify in front of Beis Din by presenting his document, and it's only one person signed on the document, and that document could serve as a proof that there was a document. So it's a shtar on a shtar. In other words, it doesn't have the status, the full-fledged status of a shtar, but it does have the status of one aid who's testifying that in my presence there was a shtar that was given from the lova over to the malva. Now, Rav Osai, let me ask you the following question. We go back to Daf Chof Amud Aleph on the bottom, and we have here a machlokus between Rav Huna and Rav Yochanan. The Gemara says the following: Omar Rabba, This is 3 lines up from the end of the daf. No, 5 lines up. Amar Rabbi Shmami no mid Rav Yochanan. What we learn from Rav Yochanan is that we're not afraid that when a person's memory is jolted, that he fools himself. He's influenced by the writing, and he really doesn't remember it. He says he remembers it. Maybe he's honestly thinking that he does remember it, but he fools himself. So Rabbi Yochanan says no. Rabbi Yochanan says if he looks into his ksav, into his own writings, he forgot everything, but now he claims he remembers everything, then we can accept his edus. And we actually rely on the fact that he claims he remembers everything. Omar Rava, Shmami Nomi Rabbi Yochanan, Betray Diyadi Sadusa. There are two witnesses who come to testify. Umitshe Chadminai, when one of the two witnesses forgot the content, the substance of the edus, Midkar Chad Lechavre. His buddy, his colleague, could remind him, and if at the end of the day his memory is jolted and he claims now he remembers the entire edus, then we can rely on him. He's not fooling himself. He actually does remember. In other words, basically Rav is saying that if Rabbi Yochanan believes that a person's own writing is a valid way of stimulating his memory so that he remembers something that he long forgot, so too his fellow aide, and he's going to now link up with him to form a kat, a unit of edus, could also remind him of what he forgot. And even though he'd completely forgotten his testimony until such time as his friend, his colleague, reminded him, it doesn't matter. If Rabbi Yochanan is willing to say that edus is valid, it's kosher, even though he forgot it, but he reminded himself based on what's written in his diary, in his handwriting, so too, another human being, in this case the aide, could remind him, and if he says, he claims that he remembers, that's fine. And why is that? Because again, he's not testifying based on his writings, he's testifying based on what he remembers. And that's where Rabbi Yochanan says that if whatever it takes to remind him of the edus that he's forgotten, that's valid and that's okay. Again, as long as the edus claims he remembers, he's got to remember it. Now, there could be an additional chiddush here in Rava's words when he says that the other aide reminds him of what they saw. On the one hand, that's, you know, we have a phrase called Dibra Kosa Behova, that's really a common kind of, you know, who's going to remind me of what I saw if not for the other person who was with me when I saw it? But there may be an additional chiddush here that, you know, one aide who remembers his edus, he's very eager to testify. And he realizes that he's now alone unless he can achieve the following goal and get his colleague to remember his edus. So in a certain sense, he's motivated to achieve this goal. And when a person is motivated to achieve this goal, it's a little bit fishy, if you know what I'm saying. What I mean to say is that, you know, how far is he going to go in order to convince his fellow witness that he really does remember? You know, you remember. What is he going to put him into a hypnotic trance? So Rava says it doesn't matter. Who cares what it takes to remind the person? As long as at the end of the day he remembers it, that validates his edus. But now the Gemara wants to know how far can we go with this? Boilu, the Gemara has the following suffix. Atzmo mai. Rashi says, Baldin atzmo mazkiro. What happens if this testimony is going to force Shimon to pay Reuven 1,000? Meaning Reuven is the malva and Shimon is the lova. Reuven comes to this aid and he says, my friend, don't you remember about 15 years ago when I extended a loan to Levi? Please come and testify on my behalf. My, can we go even this far to remind the aid of his testimony? Or perhaps we should be choshesh, maybe we should suspect that this aide is really fooling himself. He's relying on what the Baal Din told him, and he's not being honest about it. Again, I'm not telling you that he's a liar. That's what I'm saying. We're not dealing with shakronim and those who perjure themselves in a court. But sometimes a person fools himself. And we have something called a conscious mind, and then we have a subconscious mind. Okay, I don't want to get into Freudian psychology here, but this Gemara really lends itself to a psychological analysis. You could say that perhaps if the Baal Din himself, who has vested interests here, is going to influence and impact this aide to, in quotation marks, remember his aidus, maybe that's not really genuine aidus. And even though the aide is willing to, you know, swear at a stack of Bibles that he remembers his aidus, I don't know. Maybe he thinks so and he's convinced himself. But, you know, and also maybe there are nuances and elements here in the aidus which he, you know, yeah, that, I seem to remember that. You know, it was $5 billion that long. You know? Like, I didn't remember it until you reminded me. You know?
Rabbi, how does this jive with the earlier ideas that you can't add on to testimony, that has to, like, all be said at once? Here it's like he's starting and then...
Well, no. All this is happening before he comes into Bezdin.
Oh.
Rav Chaviva Omar Afilu Atzmo. Rav Chaviva says, if at the end of the day the aide claims, I remember every single detail, we believe him. And we don't think he's fooling us or himself. Mar Bereder Rav Ashi Omar Atzmo Lo. Anyone or anything could stimulate his memory except for the Baal Din who serves to gain as a result of this testimony. Vehilchus, and the Gemara finally concludes, Atzmo Lo, accepting the opinion of Mar Berei Dirav Ash. So these are the outer limits of how an aide can be reminded. Now, here I want to raise the following question before we turn to Daf Chaf Amid Beis. So nobody should turn to Daf Chaf Amid Beis, okay? No cheating here. Because I want to ask you a question. Why is it that this testimony is invalid? And that's the final halacha, like Mabrei Darash. I'm going to offer two interpretations, and then we're going to turn to Amid Beis, and you're going to tell me which one is right and which one is wrong. But first I have to convince you that both are right, or could be right. One way is to say that the Gemara is basing itself on a psychological reality that even a person who thinks he remembers and is willing to take an oath that he remembers, you know, we don't have an oath for Edom in Halacha, but I'm just using it as to dramatize my point, he could be fooling himself. You know, we think things. I know when I have discussions sometimes with my wife, I'm absolutely convinced that what I'm telling her is true until she proves to me that it's not. I fool myself sometimes. You know, we're all negev eidus as far as ourselves are concerned. That's one way of learning. The other way of learning it is no. What the Gemara is saying is that it's not a psychological principle, but it's what I call a chashad sheker. It means that somewhere in his mind, he actually realizes that he's not being totally honest about it. He's 51% sure of himself. He tips the scale a little bit. But if he'd be honest about it, he'd realize that, you know, I'm not sure that I remember the whole story. The Baal Din helped me remember. So again, let me just review my two interpretations. One is to say that this aide is being totally honest about it, but he fooled himself. He doesn't even realize the complex mechanisms of the human mind, of the human psyche. The other way is to say no. We're afraid that he's really lying to us. Again, he justifies in his mind why he's allowed to lie, because he remembers most of the case. He filled in some minor details about the price of the loan, you know, because he relied on the Valdovar. He's an old friend of his, right? But there is a chash sheker over here. And the Gemara always establishes that Edom have to be totally reliable. If they can't, if they're subject to some chashash sheker, like, for example, the Gemara says that if a person wants to testify that this piece of land belongs to someone, and that someone is someone that he borrowed money from, and he doesn't have the money to pay it back, the Gemara says we can't trust his edus, because if this karka is awarded to his malva, then his chov is paid up. And a person, even though he's not obligated to pay the chov, because, for example, he didn't take any achrayas, but nevertheless, lo v'rasha v'lo yishalim. A person doesn't want to be a rasha, and he has an outstanding loan that he never paid up. So you see that the Chazal are very, very careful about being absolutely convinced, beyond the shadow of a doubt, that the person is totally, totally honest, and therefore he's reliable. There's no such thing as a wishy-washy edus. Either it's 100% or it's nothing. You might have cases, for example, of an arev. Let's say somebody took, signed himself as a guarantor. So then, once again, he can't testify on this loan because maybe he wants to get out of his obligation. That's already a little bit more obvious.
It seems to me on the other side it's some...
Oh, you're already on the other side.
Yeah, okay. No.
I didn't turn the page.
Another perspective is that a person's not willing to give edus to come into a court unless they are convinced of what they're saying. In other words, people don't want to get involved in that unless they're pretty sure of themselves.
Right. Who wants to be an aide? You know, he's got to be totally sure. And maybe in effect that's Rav Chaviva's opinion. Therefore, Rav Chaviva validates this aid.
And was that even in terms of the issue that you're bringing up in terms of chashash sheker? It seems to me that's more difficult to say that he's walking in at just 51%. In other words, he's 49% sure he's not.
So you want to suggest that he's 100% sure?
I want to say the psychological explanation is more convincing because I think that somebody walking into court.
So let me ask you a question.
Thinking that they're lying, that there's a 49% chance I'm lying, is not the way people.
Right. If he's convinced himself 100%, he's not lying at all.
So you're saying the psychological issue might be there. So I'm saying.
Correct. And that's why we're not going to accept his aides, because he has actually successfully fooled himself. Yeah. And I claim right here in front of Amvieda that a person could convince himself of a reality that's not true. That's the way the human organism works. But then I don't understand the next line in the Gemara. Let's take a look. The Gemara says on Daf Chaf Amid Beis, "V'itzur me'rabbananu afilu atzma." So imagine the following scenario: Moshe Rabbeinu comes in to give testimony. He had completely forgotten the testimony, and he was reminded by the Valdovar. And the Gemara says that he's believed. Why? Because he's a Tzurva Mirabbanan.
What does that mean?
A Tzurva Mirabbanan is a Talmud Chacham, about which the Gemara says in Bav Metzi he will never lie. In fact, normally if you find a lost object, right, you don't return it to someone unless they give Simanim. But in the case of a Tzurva Mirabbanan who says that's my sweater, I can't prove it to you with any identification marks, then you return it to him, because he would never lie. And he looks at that sweater and he has what's called a tefiyas ayin, he remembers, he knows that's his sweater. Again, today it's a little bit difficult to understand the Gemara, because today everything is mass produced, you know, manufacturing, and when one sweater looks like a million other sweaters. But back in the day when they were more into, you know, weaving their own garments, you know, every garment looked a little bit different. He can't give you a simon. He can't tell you that there's a red ribbon inside the left collar, but he could tell you, that's mine. He would never lie. Even though, by the way, but that's not for us tonight, there are three occasions in which even a Talmud Chacham is allowed to lie. But that has nothing to do with us. That's not in the case of an aid, of a witness. You know, if a Talmid Chacham is testifying, then he's totally reliable.
But this is going deeper into the psychology now.
So here's what I want to ask you.
You can go both ways.
Bishlema, again, you'll argue with me, but let me present Berzon's opinion, and then you'll present your opinion, Aaron. I wanted to say the following. Bishlema, if you'll tell me that the problem with Atzmo, when the Baldovar reminds him, is Sheker, that he's playing around, and he's really lying, and he knows that he's not 100% sure, but... you know, it's uncomfortable for him since he's pretty sure and his good buddy is asking him to testify on his behalf. Then I can understand that a Tzuvah Rabbanon would be outside of that chashash. There's no chashash sheker in the case of a Tzuvah Rabbanon. But if you're going to tell me that the human psyche is built in such a way that a person can convince himself of something, then I find it difficult to say that a Tzuvah Rabbanon, with all due respect to his scholarship, and he's been tested on four Chelkei Shulchan Aruch, therefore, he will not fool himself? I don't know. I find it a little weak. Go ahead. What do you say?
I don't know. I mean, you could argue that as well in terms of his midos, in terms of the, not only in terms of his learning, but his character, that he's not going to be affected by that psychological piece in the same way that others would be.
But okay, right. I'm a skeptic.
you're
allowed your opinion. I can just tell you I'm very skeptical about that because I agree, maybe I'm projecting my, you know, this is like I'm projecting myself here. Not that I'm a Tzuvah Rabbanon, but I'm just saying if I was a Tzuvah Rabbanon, I would still be fooling myself. There's so many occasions in which we fool ourselves, you know. We think we see red, but it's really black.
Not in court, not when you're giving aides. That's
again, if you fooled yourself, you're absolutely convinced and you'll take a shvuah d'oraisa so that what you're saying is true. Because again, there are so many parts of the complex mind that one part could convince the other.
You're also opening yourself up to being an aides zomim. Like, it's a huge risk. I don't think someone would take it so lightly. No.
Yeah, and that's what Aaron was saying before. But I'm just suggesting that the reason why he's not afraid of Hazama is because he has convinced himself. Now, there's a third way of learning this Gemara, which would be even more difficult, but I like it the most. I'll tell you why I like it the most, because if I were to sit in Rav Soloveitchik's shiur, and Rav Soloveitchik asked, well, what's the machlokas here between Rav Chaviva, who we love so much, his Habibi, and Marbar Avashi. And I would say, well, they're arguing about a Freudian principle here. Will a person convince himself of a certain truth in which he actually believes that it's true when it's really not true? Rav Habibi said it can't be. A person would not do that. And Marbar Avashi says he could. So Rav Soloveitchik would say to me one or two things. Either he'd say to me, Berzon, pack your bags, you know, you're out of here. Or he would say to me, Berzon, you haven't really studied under a true Torah giant. Because there's no such thing as a machlokes on a psychological principle. We don't argue psychology. I remember back in the day, there was a guy in the Shia who's the loveliest, most edel guy in the world. The Rav had him pegged as a philosopher. I don't know why. Maybe he studied philosophy in college. I don't know. Every time the guy raised his hand to make a comment, before he could open his mouth, the Rav would say to him, no philosophy. The poor guy. And this went on for years. And the last thing in his mind was to say philosophy, but some of the Rav had him pegged, and that was it. You know. So I would like to suggest the following. I haven't worked this out, you know, ironed it out, but again, it's not going to be good for Tzuvah Rabbanon. So I tell you right up front that what I'm saying to you is Lechora is absolutely wrong. But maybe the machlokas is the following. That Eidus is not just the actual story, what we call the Sipur Dvarim, that the Eid presents to Bezdin. In other words, Yesh Lachkor, what is Eidus? The first definition of Eidus is intuitive. Eidus has a beginning and an end. The beginning is when he starts his story, and the end is when he finishes his story, or whenever they finish interrogating him. And that's the simple understanding of Eidus. But perhaps we could say that Eidus includes not only the actual testimony, but it incorporates within it even the process of knowledge that brings to that testimony. For example, what would you say about the following? Two witnesses saw a crime together. Let me say it to you this way. Three witnesses saw a crime together. One is Pasul. Let's say he's a relative. The Pasul drops out before they get to Beis Din. So at the time when the testimony is actually presented to Beis Din, from beginning to end, the Pasul is not in the picture. We don't have a puzzle, a rotten apple to spoil the bunch, so the Eidus is kosher. Well, I have you know, if you don't know this, that some Rishonim are of the opinion that since the puzzle saw the Eidus with them, that itself makes him part of the Eidus. And even if he drops out before the actual Haggadah, he has what's called the Shem Eid. And since he's an Eid puzzle, we have a principle called Nimtza Echad Mehem Karav Puzzle, Kulam Pseil, which is a Mishnah Masechta. Makos. Okay, good. We haven't forgotten. The good old Makos thing. So what I'm trying to prove is that we have this very parochial, narrow view of Eidus with bookends, but maybe the scope of the Eidus includes much more than just the actual testimony, the Sipur HaDvarim, the Haggadah Beis Din. Maybe Eidus includes within it the process of knowledge, which starts with Re'iyah, when you saw the testimony, the event, but there may be different points on the way, stations on the way. For example, you saw something, but you forgot it. Well, now I saw it again. How did I see it again? Because I remembered it at some point. So there was time T1 when I saw the Eidus, and I was very much aware, it was fresh in my mind. Time T2 when I forgot the Eidus. Time T3 when I again remembered that which I forgot. That also is part of the Eidus. If that be the case, then maybe what Mar Bar Avashi is saying, that Al-Pidin, on a halachic level, this is not a psychological principle, this Eidus is possible. Because the process of knowledge, of reawakening my awareness of what I've forgotten, came through the Baldovar himself, the Baldovar and his, so to speak, testimony, which aroused within me my memory, is part of the Eidus itself. In other words, what Mar Bar Avashi is trying to present here as a Gvaldige Chiddush is that the source of memory, you follow what I mean? The source of the memory is also part of the Eidus. It somehow integrates into the broader definition of the Eidus. And if that be the case, then if the source of the Eidus was Atzmo, which Rashi says is the Baldin Atzmo, then the Eidus is possible. The Baldin who reminds him becomes part of the Eidus. So that if, for example, the other aid reminded him, well, the other aid is kosher li Eidus, and therefore it doesn't create any psul in the Eidus. If, for example, he looks at his own writing, well, his own writing can't be a Maisa Haggadah, but it's perfectly objective, and it doesn't in any way upset or undermine the Eidus, if that becomes the source to remind him of his testimony. But if the Baldover himself becomes the source for reminding him, that already adds an element of psul in the Eidus itself. The only problem with that pshat is it could be a very nice lumdish way of conceptualizing the machlokas between Mar Bar Avashi and Rabbi Chaviva, but why should it be any different in the case of a Tzurma Mirabbanan? From the fact that the Gemara says that Tzurma Mirabbanan is different, it would prove that the whole business here is a Chashash Sheker. And with regard to Chashash Sheker, we have the exceptional case of the Tzurma Mirabbanan.
We can't give you the answer, possibly the Tzurma Mirabbanan is like an aid who's like a Baki, and therefore he's like his own category, because he's familiar with all the Las Vedas, and he's familiar with all these things. Like, you can't.
Well, the only question I would ask you, Aaron, is let's say we take your rank and file citizen. He's not a Tzurma Mirabbanan. He may have a PhD from Harvard, but he did not get smicha from a well-recognized yeshiva, right? Again, exactly what fits into that category is a matter of debate. Correct? So he comes into Beis Din, and Beis Din lays down the rules in front of him. He's an intelligent guy. And they say to him, listen, buddy, you want to give Eidus? Do you remember your Eidus? They can ask him that question. How do you remember your Eidus? Was there a point at which you forgot your Eidus? So I don't know if scholarship here, the knowledge of the laws of Eidus, should play a role here, because B'chik, we can apprise him of all the fundamentals of Eidus. I'm not saying he's gonna know every nuance of the Sma and the Taz and Hilchos Eidus. But
weren't there things that we learned before, like you have to give Hasra, you have to, like, there are like certain things that have to...
But every one of those elements are going to be part of the interrogations. Beis Din is not going to assume a thing. Even if he's the greatest scholar in the world, Rav Moshe Feinstein comes into Beis Din to give Eidus, we're going to ask him all the questions in order to make his Eidus solid and complete. Okay. Now, Rabotai, one question I want you to keep in the back of your mind and try not to forget it. That was a pun. Okay. Is how long of a period of time can elapse between the event and the testimony? Is there some sort of law, a ceiling, that says a person can't remember something? We all avoid. The human mind eventually forgets things. Okay, then keep that in the back of your mind as we go through the sugya, because it's possible, although maybe unlikely, but it's possible that there is a limitation rule here. You know, you can't say that you saw something 90 years ago, you know, and you remember what you saw. You still remember what you saw. You're 110, and you remember what you saw at the age of 20. This guy just died recently. Somebody told me he was 116. Is that a true story, or it's just a legend? Was he a Yemenite?
I don't know him personally. Oh.
So they say that to Tamanim, that they live very long. You remember the jokes, yeah? No, this Yemenite comes to buy, you know, life insurance. So the how do you say, the agent asks him, well, how old are you? He says, I'm 78. He says, you know, that's a problem. He says, no, I'm buying this for my father. Anyway, those are the jokes. So he says the following. Ki hadar Rav Ashi, here's the story about Rav Ashi. Havi yediyah leh b'sa'aduso l'Rav Kahana. He knew testimony on behalf of Rav Kahana. Amar leh, so Rav Kahana said to Rav Ashi, mi dechir mar hai sa'aduso. He says, just want to remind you that you have the following testimony to give on my behalf. Mi dachir, the dalet in Aramaic substitutes for the zayin. Mi zachir mar. Does my master remember the following Eidus? Holy, Rav Ashi responds, lo, I have no recollection. Now Rav Kahana is not willing to give up. This is an important testimony. He says, v'lav hachi v'hachi hava, can I just remember and remind you that it was kach v'kach? You know, these were the details. Holy, lo, you're done, I can't remember. L'basof, all of a sudden Rav Ashi woke up in the middle of a sleep one night, and Idkar Rav Ashi, and he remembered the Eidus, the Asidle. So he came into Beis Din and he testified on behalf of Rav Kahana. And after the testimony was given, Chazye, Rav Ashi saw that Rav Kahana dahavi mechasem. Mechasem means he was like shaking. He was kind of he was very uncomfortable about it. Meaning, maybe Rav Ashi, you shouldn't have given this Eidus, because you know, you convinced me over and over again that you forgot the Eidus. Amalei. So Rav Ashi said, Mi savris Allah kasamichna. You think that I'm relying on what you told me? Anohu deramai anafshe viadkare. I took it upon myself. Ramay anafshe means it was mutalalai. It was like a responsibility hovering over my head. Viadkare, until I finally woke up and he remembered. So again, for a rank and file citizen, this would not be acceptable Eidus, but since Rav Ashi is a Tzurma Rabbanon, therefore the Eidus is acceptable. So this whole piece of Gemara here with the story is coming to teach us that in the case of a Tzurma Rabbanon, even the Baal Dover himself could be the source to stimulate his memory. Okay then? Alright. Now we're up to Tnan Hasam. Now, Rabosai, we're about 10 lines down. What? How many lines is it? 8 lines down from the top. And our first goal for tonight, after whatever we accomplished so far, is to get to the Mishnah on the bottom of the page. Now, in order to do that, we have to know Tanan. We have to know another Mishnah, Hasan. Where is Hasan? So if I ever want to know where the Gemara is coming from, where do I look? That's called the Mesoras HaShas. I'm talking to you like I talk to fifth graders here. Okay? So if you take a look at the Mesoras HaShas on the top, where is this coming from? Don't answer at once. What?
That's
Olos. Olos. Now, I have to tell you the honest truth. I once learned Olos. Why did I learn Olos? Because when they divvied up Mishnayis Shas for someone's Yahrzeit, no, excuse me, for someone's Shloshim, nobody wanted to take Olos. So I figured, Berzon, you're a brilliant guy, you'll take Olos. All I can tell you is that to this day, as soon as you mention Mishnayis Olos, I start shaking. I have total nightmares from those 30 days of trying to learn Masechta Olos. It was horrible. I got a hold of an English Olos, a translation. It's all about corpses and dead bodies and contracting tuba, which that itself wouldn't scare me. I mean, not that I love dead bodies, but it is the most complicated Masechta Shas. By the way, if you're interested, there's a sefer, maybe you heard of it, called Chidushei Rabbeinu Chaim Alevi Al Rambam. 40% of that sefer is on Olos. The Rav once told us that Rav Chaim very often would be overwhelmed by a fear of death. And as soon as that happened to him, and he got shook it up, he would take out Masechta Olos and he started smiling and laughing. You know, he just... learning with Seth Ollis put him in a great mood. It didn't do it for me. That I have to tell you. So as soon as I see Tanan Hassan with the Mesoras HaShas, I want to run away from him. But I can't do that because they'll fire me. So what I'm going to do is I'm going to try to make an attempt at understanding this mission in Ollis. Okay then? Fine. Now let's just review what, you know, what we should know in order to learn Masechta Ollis. There are various levels of tumah. The highest level is a human corpse. And that halal is called avi avos hatumah, which means that anyone who comes in contact with a dead body, whether it's a human being that comes in contact with a dead body or a utensil, a kli, that itself becomes what's called an avatumah. So the power, you know, normally we think that the highest level of tumah, you know, the rishon, the shady, and this and that, the highest level is the avatumah. That's not true. There's something above the avatumah that's called the avia vosatumah, and that's called a corpse, a dead body. Now,
Jewish, not Jewish, it's not.
Let's assume it's a Jewish body, okay? Fine. Now, what happens if someone contracts tumah by being in contact with a dead body, which means he either touched the body, he carried the body, or he was in an ohel, in a house with that body. Of course, Aaron, this should never happen to you because you're a kohen, so you really have to be super careful about making sure, like you go into a hospital like Shari Tzedek, they'll tell you on the outside, you know, no kohenim in now. There's a corpse in the hospital. And rarely you can go in there. From time to time. You probably have to run out immediately after you go in. But anyway, now, what happens if a person comes in contact with a dead body? So he's tummy for 7 days, and he needs what's called hazoya of the Efer HaPara, the Paraduma, twice during this 7-day period. After that, he can go to the mikvah. So it's a whole long to-do. And it's not very, you know, it's not a comfortable situation to be in. It's a real chumrah, but that's the nature of a mess, of a dead body. Okay. Now, back in the day, they didn't always bury someone in a cemetery. It wasn't as organized as it is today. And on occasion, they had to bury someone very quickly, on the road, so to speak. But in such a case, they need what's called a tziyun kever. that according to Allah, they should really put a marker there so that people will know, first and foremost, Kohanim, but not only Kohanim, but others who don't want to contract tumor, because as I said before, it's a whole thing, they should know not to go in there. Now, obviously a cemetery is off bounds, you know, that's for sure a tumor, a metame, but what happens outside the cemetery? Let's say, for example, imagine the case of a road that leads to the cemetery. And for whatever reason, they didn't make it to the cemetery. They buried the mess on the road. Why would that happen? Maybe it was Erev Shabbos and there wasn't enough time to get to the cemetery.
I don't know.
Yeah, whatever it might be. They didn't have time to this. Now, a road is a very well-populated, well-trodden place. In a pure ideal world, there should have been a tziyun kever there, a matzeva of some sort. Again, our concept of matzeva is a totally different concept. That's not just to keep the kohanim away, but that's also l'chavad shel mes. But, you know, back in the day, a matzeva really was primarily a way, a marker of telling people, stay away from here because you'll contract tumor. Now, on the road, it would be a very stupid thing to bury a corpse. Because basically you're putting a michshol for anyone going by to trample over this. Oh, I mentioned ohel, meaning if you're in the same ohel. There's also another halacha of being mahil al mes, which means that if you bend over a mess, this is the whole issue of airplanes. You know, because if an airplane goes over a cemetery, then you're being ma'il al mes. Again, don't ask me how you get out of that. I once actually sat next to a Kohen on an El Al flight. He had a brown sack, and his body was covered up to here, from the feet up, in the sack. Mm. Okay, you have to know the laws of chatzitza and tumah, and so forth and so on. But anyway, basically, tumah is all out your akim. So it's a very stupid thing to bury a person on the road because people are going to go over that point and they're going to contract tumor. That's a terrible thing to do. So, you know, if for some urgent reason it has to happen, make sure there's a tziyun kever there. However, there are places on the side of the road where the premise, the assumption is nobody goes there. And that's called a tail. In this particular Mishnah, Tav Lamed. Now, what's a tail? A tail in English, I think, is a heap. What does it mean, a heap? Sometimes, excuse me, when they dig, they throw the debris into a place until it piles up. So it's like a man-made hill, if you will. Nobody goes into the hill or jumps over the hill. It's off the side of the road. And therefore, if need be, that's actually a good place to bury the dead. But it works the other way too, that if somebody does end up on a mound, for whatever reason, he climbs up there to get a bit of view, I don't know what, then there may be an assumption that there's a dead body buried inside the mound, and therefore, he contracts to it. That's the subject of this Mishnah in Masechta Olos in the 15th perek, and it says the following: Tanan Hosa Hatlulios. This is the plural of Tilim, of Tile Afar, meaning these are mounds of dirt that are situated on the sides of the road, so that if they didn't make it to the Beis HaKvaras on their way out this road, that would be perhaps a good place to bury the dead. Because they don't believe that under normal circumstances anyone's going to go into that tail. The law is hakrovos, if they're close to the city limits. And the closer you are to the city limits, the more the greater the statistical probability or possibility that somebody might actually, on his way out to the cemetery, bury someone in that tail. Bein la'ir ubein la'derech, whether it be within a certain close proximity or a radius to the outlying, to the outskirts of the city, or whether it's off the road, echad chadoshos v'echad yeshanos. Okay, we'll come back to that in a minute. Tmeos, meaning the premise is that there is a corpse there. Again, the Gemara is going to go bonkers here. Why should we assume that there's definitely a corpse there? The person has a cheskes tara, and now you're inventing this possibility. You know, you're being very creative here and saying a whole story that somebody was on his way out of the city, couldn't get to the cemetery in time, so they buried him in this heap. I mean, why should we suspect that? But that's going to be the sugya as it develops. Now, what's Chadoshos and what's Yeshanos? So we don't know exactly how much of a time period is long enough to make it into a Yeshanos, meaning an older one. Older, meaning the word old is relative. But let's say it's more than, you know, it's more than 50 years old, okay?
The
mound itself. In other words, when was this mound humanly formed? You know, founded in year so-and-so. That's it says something. And if it's Rechokos, I'm sorry, if it's Yeshanos, right, if it's an old mound, then who remembers, you know, the ancient history, you know, from 50 years ago, whether there was a corpse that was buried there or not? But the Chiddush is that even in the case of Chadoshos, well, if there was a corpse buried there, we would know about it, because this mound is only a few months old. Nevertheless, we're still going to assume that since it has the element of Krovos, it's close to the city or to the road, there is a possibility that although we don't know about it, somebody stealthily, secretly hid a dead body in that tale. Now, I'm going to give you a little bit of a forwards of what the Gemara is going to say. Why would somebody have done such a thing? And how come we don't know about it? You know, generally speaking, burial is a pretty public kind of thing. The answer is that back in the day, if a woman had never a miscarriage, she was very embarrassed about that. And what she would do is, in the middle of the night sometimes, she would go out to try to find a burial place for this stillborn or whatever the case may be. And if the fetus developed over a certain amount of time, and for that again you have to learn from Seth Olos pretty clear, let's say it's after 3 months, then it's metami mes. And this fetus was buried, and nobody knows about it, in the tale. Again, and why did this happen? Because she never made it to the cemetery. You know, if all things would have been equal, she would have buried it in the cemetery. But, you know, it was the middle of the night. She was afraid to go all the way to the cemetery, and I don't know where the grave diggers were. So she buried the Nafel inside this heap. Wow. And this is even Chadoshos, because we don't know about it. Then the Mishnah says, Rechokos, if there's a very long distance between this tell and the outskirts of the city, or the outskirts of, or the road, then nobody would get that far and go travel out there to the tell and bury. You know, that far she won't go. And therefore, the halacha is whether it's Rechokos, whether it's Chadoshos, I'm sorry, if it's Rechokos, which means it's far away from the city, if it's Chadoshos, okay, then it's relatively new, this man-made mound, Tahoros. Then we don't assume that somebody buried someone that far out or that recently and we don't know about it. And because it's Rechokos and Chadoshos, it has two pluses, right? It's Tahoros. Now he has here in the Masifta the possibility that you read it thusly. He says you read it as Rechokos, O Rechokos. Just 1 second. No. He has Rechokos means no matter whether it's new or old, but if it's far away from the city, we don't assume that anyone buried a Nafel there. But Chadoshos. Right, even if it's within, just one second. In the case of Chadoshos, this Chadoshos. Wait, what? I'm sorry, I got a little confused. What's Chadoshos, Tahoros? So I'm sorry, I made a mistake. It has to be both Rechokos and Chadoshos, correct? So if you have the combination of those two, then Tahoros. But if it was Rechokos Yeshanos, it was far away, but it's old, Tmeos. Because then the fact that we don't know that somebody buried there simply because such a long period of time has passed, and therefore we don't remember that somebody was actually buried there.
What about Krova Tadasha? That's also...
So again, let me say it to this way, and see if we can get the answer to your question. The only case in which it's Tahoros is going to be when we combine Rechokos with Chadoshos. Only if you can check off those two boxes is it Tahoros. In the absence of that, in other words, if it's either Krovos or it's Yeshanos, then automatically, ipso facto, it becomes Tmeos. Okay. Now here's the punchline as far as our sugya is concerned, because again, we want to know if there's a limit, a roof, a ceiling, how long can an event have passed by since the event, and the Eidim can still say, we remember what happened so long ago. Ezi Krova. Okay, so actually what we want to get to is Ezihi Chadosh, so we'll get to that soon. Ezi Krova, what's considered close to the city, and therefore there's a real serious chashash that somebody buried the Nefel there, is up to Chamishim Amah. So you draw a circle around the city limits, the outer city limits, and the distance between the outer city limits and this circle is 50 Amah.
It's really close.
It's pretty close, because she wouldn't go beyond 50 Amah. Especially it's in the middle of the night, she's trying to do this under the mantle of darkness, she's afraid to go that far. Ezihi Yeshana. Oh, this is the part, that this is the punchline for our purposes. Shishim Shana Divrei Rabbi Meir. In other words, when we say that if it's Yeshana, then even though it's far away from the city, but nevertheless it's so old and such an ancient mound, founded in the year, let's see, where are we up to today? We're 2017, right? Lemin Yonim. So what do you get if you subtract 60 from 217? You get
57.
So it'll be 1957. So it says founded 1957. Who remembers back to 1957 whether or not there was a corpse buried there? So that even though it's Rechokos, it's still Tmeos. Correct? If it's less than 60 years old, then we still retain it in our memory. And since we combine that with the fact that it's Rechokos, which itself is a rarity, that she should go that far to, you know, beyond 50 Amah, therefore Tahoros. Rabbi Yehuda Omer, no, it's all relative. There's no standard Krova, She'ein Krova Heimena. In other words, Krova refers to one specific tail. Only that tail, which is closest to the city, that tail is considered Krova, and that's where the Chash is. That is a Nefel there. But the next tail over, even though it's relatively close to the city, within 50 Amah, it's already considered Rechoka, and therefore Tmeah. Yeshana, She'ein Adam Zochra. Yeshana is also relative. We can't find one person who can remember the foundation date of that mound. When was that mound created? My ear, umay derech. What do we mean by a city and a derech? Ilema ir, ir mamish. If it's just a general city, like any other city. Now, keep in mind, not every city had its own cemetery. So you could have a serious sized city, but there's no cemetery. So the Gemara says that's impossible. Derech, derech mamish, and derech means a regular road. So the Gemara says, misfeka mimach zekin and tuma. You have a suffix that outside this city, somebody buried the dead in a mound, outside or nearby some sort of road, somebody buried a Nefel, and therefore we're going to be metame anyone who comes in contact with that mound? That's not so. The halacha doesn't work like that. We don't create sveikos. And by the way, this applies here in Eretz Yisrael. We don't create sveikos to make people tame, just out of the clear blue. You have to have a real serious reason to believe that he contracted tumah. And I'll prove it to you. V'amar Reish Lakish, there's a statement of Reish Lakish in Masechta Nazir. Ila matzu v'tiru be'eretz Yisrael. In Hebrew we say the magama, meaning the goal, the agenda, is to try to be metayer Eretz Yisrael, places in Eretz Yisrael. In other words, even when we do have some sort of a chashash of tumah, we try as much as we can, says Reish Lakish, to be metayer places, not to be metame places. So why would the chacham have such a chumrah that every time you have a tail in any outside any city in Israel or any road, you're going to have a chashash tumah and be metame someone who has a cheskes tara? On Rav Zera, no, we're not talking about any city, but Ir Hasmucha LeBeis HaKvaros means that there's a cemetery located right there near, out on the outskirts of the city. Or Derech means Derech Beis HaKvaros. There's a road that will lead you to the Beis HaKvaros. So we're afraid that she was going outside the city. She really had in mind to get to the cemetery. She didn't make it to the cemetery. She was on this derech to the Beis HaKvaros. She didn't make it that far. Then there's a chashash in the tail. But if you have a stam derech or a stam ear, then there's no chashash. Bishleima, the Gemara says, derech Beis HaKvaros. I can understand, says the Gemara, that if there's a derech that brings you beyond the city limits to the cemetery, right? So you have this road that connects the city to the cemetery. Zimnin de Misrame ben Ashmoshas. I can understand that maybe they were trying to bury a person on Erev Shabbos ben Ashmoshas. It was getting close to Shkia. They were on the road that links them to the cemetery. They didn't make it on time. Mikru, it chanced upon the Kavru Batel. So what they did was they decided, what's the best place to bury this dead? Erev Shabbos, a few minutes before Shkia. Let's bury him in the mound. Eleir Asmucha LeBeis HaKvaros. If you have a tail that's outside of a Beis HaKvaros, is Kulu LeBeis HaKvaros Asli. If this tail is in close proximity to the Beis HaKvaros, outside the city limits, then let's assume the person would go into the Beis HaKvaros and bury. Why do you have a chashash that they buried the dead in a tell that's outside the city? And there is a Beis HaKvaros outside the city. It's close to the city. Why wouldn't they have gone the extra 9 yards, you know, to bury the dead in the cemetery? Omer Rav Chanina, mitoch shanoshim kovros sham niflehem. This is what I let you know from the get-go, that there's a case where a woman had a hapola nebuch, and as a result she wanted to bury the nephel as soon as she could. She went out of the city, and you know that's where she found a place, right outside the city. She didn't even make it to the Beis HaKvaros. Then the Gemara has something which is totally, you know, repulsive, but this is what the Gemara says: Umuki shchin zrosehem. Basically, you're talking about a person who had an amputated arm, and the arm itself is considered. That's what he quotes here from a sugin chulin as an aver menachai, an aver menachai. As far as tuma, has the same status as an aver menames. I mean, this reminds me of the Holocaust. But anyway, so what they did was they would try to find a quick place to bury it. And they don't bury a limb in a Beis HaKvaros. That would probably be too expensive. So they bury it inside a tail, and it's outside the city. Ad chamishim ama ozla ihi lechuda. In other words, if she's alone, because she's doing this without any publicity, she'll go out alone up to 50 amma. But fei, more than 50 amma, davra inish bahada. You know, she'll definitely want to take another person with her, and then we'll know about it. Ulebeis HaKvaros Oslo, maybe now she'll have, you know, she'll be able to, she's not afraid, so she'll go with this other person who is escorting her all the way to the Beis HaKvaros Hilchot. Tuma Be'eretz Yisrael Lomach Zekinon. When this tail is far away from the city, beyond 50 amos, we don't have any worry. Hilchash. Or Rav Chisda. Shmami nomi Rebbe Lozer Haisadusa ad shitin shnin mitkere. We can learn from Rebbe Meir that the maximum time you can remember something is up to 60 years. Tfei lo mitkere. A person will not remember beyond 60 years. Velohi. After this whole libud of all those It has nothing to do with that sugya of edus. Hasam hu delo ram yale. In the case of kruas hames, nobody's obligated to remember, you know, some sort of chov, you know, mutal al adam lezochro, that he should remember that which happened so many years ago. Al hacha, in the case of edus, ram yale, he has to remember his edus, afilu tuvanami, he'll remember even more than 60 years. We can open this door and we'll be able to answer Baruch Hu.